against ballots. Mr. Gregory.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Gregory and I represent the appellant, Jack Vallinati. This case presents a de novo question of contract interpretation and the application of basic rules of construction to the operating agreement of Omnibus Financial Group, or OFG. The reason we're here is because Magistrate Judge Ashman, his interpretation of the agreement, latched on to the single word, to, at the expense of and in order to allow an interpretation which was inconsistent with the terms of the agreement, inconsistent with the structure of the agreement when it's viewed as a whole, and inconsistent, completely inconsistent, with the purposes of the agreement and with logic. Once Bayless bought out Vallinati's interest in OFG, the operating agreement required Bayless to provide full indemnification to Vallinati with respect to the personal guarantees he had made of OFG's debt.
Mr. Bayless has argued that your interpretation of Section 9J contradicts Section 11C by absolving the resigning member of his personal guarantee obligation. How do you respond?
I think that, Your Honor, Judge Ashman adopted that same reasoning, which is he was concerned that a member could just up and leave and leave the remaining member behind with all of the obligations. And I respectfully submit that that fails to take all of the agreement into account. And in particular, it fails to take into account Section 11C, which was designed exactly to address that precise issue. And it prohibited a departing member from saying, I'm out of here, I don't like the direction, I resign. It prohibited him from walking away from the guarantee obligation. And so it works consistently with 9J and with 10C. The three sections, consecutive sections, provide a comprehensive resolution for the issue. 9J deals with the allocation when they're both members. 10C deals with the allocation when there's been a change of ownership by virtue of the 10B buy-sell cooperative process. And 11C deals with the allocation when someone simply up and resigns. It provides a comprehensive solution.
I have a hard time understanding what a value Ballas got for taking over your client's $100,000 personal guarantee.
Well, he received $79,000 for one thing. He received...
Well, not necessarily. He received the value of the note.
Right.
But since the company seems to have been underwater, the note might not have had any real value.
Well, in fact, the note was paid. So he received the value of the note. He received any and all upside potential of the company. And he's the one who made the completely subjective determination as to what to set the interest value at. He's the one who made the decision to set the interest value at negative $79,000. And you can't have a negative interest value unless you take the personal guarantee risk into account. And Judge Ashman called that speculation. That's not speculative at all. This was a limited liability company, and the members would not have had any exposure for the debts of the company without the personal guarantee obligation. So he had to have taken that into account. This was very much a part of the purchase price formula. Now Judge Ashman and Bayless himself indicate,
the difficulty, I think there's a lot to that argument, but the difficulty is that it then uses the limited liability as a fulcrum for breaching limited liability for Ballas. He no longer has limited liability, which one supposed was the attributes of the shares. When the buy-sell agreement is used, suddenly Ballas's limited liability has vanished. He's now responsible for corporate debts. How does that happen?
They both were before, by virtue of the personal guarantees.
They each had their own personal guarantees.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They each had...
Right. And they were liable on the guarantee, not liable on the shares.
That's exactly
right.
But
your argument is that when the buy-sell agreement was executed, Ballas became liable on his shares in addition to being liable on his guarantee.
No, he became liable for 100% of the guarantee, whereas by virtue of 9J previously, he was liable only for 50%.
No. Each person made a personal guarantee.
Correct.
And was liable for 100% of that.
To the third party.
Your argument is that although the way this agreement works, the company, the limited liability company, had an obligation to indemnify your client for the guarantee. That's the way guarantees work.
No.
Yes. Unless the law of Illinois has suddenly turned upside down, you could go to the company and get indemnity on paying out on the guarantee. Now, of course, since the company is underwater, that right isn't worth very much. But your argument is that that obligation got transferred to Ballas personally, and that amounts to saying that he no longer had the attributes of limited liability on his shares.
No, pursuant to this agreement, pursuant to 9J, the indemnification right that Vallinati had, or Ballas had for that matter, had the bank come and collected 100%, pursuant to 9J, the indemnification right would have been to go to the other member, because the members, and there is no other operating agreement. This is intended to be all-inclusive and comprehensive, because under 9J...
You don't even need this agreement to get to get liability over on a guarantee. It's part of the law of suretyship. As I say, unless the law of Illinois is turned upside down, and the law of suretyship has been repealed, which, to my knowledge, it has not, your client gets indemnity on this guarantee from the limited liability company. It just turns out to be worthless.
And because of this agreement, he also gets and is entitled to indemnity from the other member. If you look at 9J, that's exactly what 9J provides. The members covenant and agree that if any member executes and delivers any such guarantee, and if such guaranteeing member incurs any cost or liability in connection therewith, then such cost shall be allocated among and shared by all of the members in accordance with their respective membership interests. So the question that Judge Ashman struggled with is, when do you take that snapshot and decide what is the respective membership interests? Is it at the time the guarantee is made, or is it at the time that the costs associated with that guarantee are actually sustained? And the answer has to be clear, that it's at the time the costs are incurred. That's in any indemnification, that's when the cause of action accrues. And in fact, Judge Ashman's analysis is internally inconsistent.
I don't know whether you're now not proving too much from your perspective, because you're now, by relying on 9J, explaining why, in your view, a member's shares might have a negative value. Because Vallinotti, your client, was potentially liable under Section 9J for Ballas's guarantee.
That's right.
Therefore, his shares could easily have a negative value, without any implication that when the buy-sell agreement happened, Ballas then had the full obligation.
But that's exactly right. In the formula, because of the personal guarantees, because of them, you have a negative interest value.
Do you persist in believing that this contract is unambiguous?
I believe that the language is clear. I believe that the structure is clear. I believe the purposes are clear, and that, yes, it's compelling that this be interpreted only one way. I think that this court has held that a contract is ambiguous if it can be fairly and reasonably interpreted in more than one way. I think it can only fairly and reasonably be interpreted this way, but I submit respectfully that under any scenario, the interpretation that we're putting forward is certainly fair and a reasonable one. Judge Ashman, he indicated that he recognized that when new members come in, by virtue of 9J, they assume some responsibility. Yet he didn't follow the logic of his own reasoning and say that, therefore, a departed member, that it changes. He's got a completely different structure for when a departed member leaves as opposed to when a new member comes. And he's made his own analysis is somewhat inconsistent. You cannot, both Judge Ashman and Bayless have urged the court to find that, well, personal guarantees aren't specifically listed in the purchase price formula. And Judge Ashman went so far as to say, well, it would have been easy to put it in a formula. I don't believe that that's right at all, because valuing the risk associated with a personal guarantee, in fact, this agreement was signed before there even were personal guarantees, at some point in the future, it's not arithmetic. Unlike valuing a loan, a $100,000 loan has a $100,000 value. You don't know in advance whether the risk associated with a personal guarantee will be 100%, 50%, 10%. So it couldn't have been put in the formula as a specific articulated item, but it was in the formula by virtue of the interest value. This, as I said, was intended to be a comprehensive solution to all of the issues that arise. The argument that Bayless is making is that notwithstanding that this was
there are an awful lot of closely held companies that have buy-sell clauses. I mean, one would think that the form books available for this purpose would have a clause for what you do about guarantees. Is that true?
I don't know. I wish that I had been involved when the agreement was drafted. I believe that it's a comprehensive agreement, but
it may not be a comprehensive agreement. I mean, it was possible to find a parallel for things that were going on in Section 10 in closely held company form books, but not for what was going on in Section 9.
Well, and I think that it was dealt with by virtue of Section 11C, which is a very significant section. The section that Judge Ashman simply said was related to a different purpose. I don't believe it was. It provided part of this comprehensive resolution. And if there are no other questions, I've reserved the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Gregory.
Thank you.
Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is a very simple case. It turns
totally. Yeah. The two of you agree that the document is unambiguous. Right. You just don't agree on what it means.
Correct.
That's always a bad sign.
Well, fortunately, we have the agreement itself to look to. And the agreement itself is what governs here. Your Honor is right that there are some standard provisions, some non-standard provisions. The record contains a detailed affidavit of the attorney who wrote this agreement, Mr. Mills, and that affidavit states that Mr. Bayless's interpretation of the agreement is entirely correct and consistent with the intent of the parties. But we don't need to look at that affidavit, Your Honors, because we don't need to look at that because the agreement itself is so clear and plain. 10C is the provision that governs here. It's a transfer of interest. What does Mr. Bayless have to take over upon a Section 10B transaction?
Forgive me for a minute, but I'm not certain that you answered how Mr. Bayless could reach a negative number for the interest value. unless he took the personal guarantees into account?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, in the record, we do have the deposition of Mr. Bayless, we have the deposition of everybody, but the other side hasn't introduced any evidence of any kind to say that Mr. Bayless took the personal guarantees into account in coming up with a negative interest value. The simple
effect...
In what
other way could a negative value have been generated? That was my colleague's question. It was the challenge in your adversary's brief, and your brief is conspicuously silent on this. And it seems to me a very important question.
Well, it is an important question, Your Honor. I think what the clear answer to the question is that by choosing the figure that Mr. Bayless did, he ended up with a value for...
Yeah, we know that. In what way, consistent with your understanding of this agreement, could a negative value have been generated?
Because the company was going to continue to bleed and bleed and bleed, and the only way that the company could be supported is through the personal resources of the members. During the time...
This is a really simple question. Your client owns shares, and Valinodi owns shares, in a company with limited liability. Under what circumstances, even if the company is totally bankrupt and utterly, about to be scattered to the wolves, can shares have a negative value?
That's when Mr. Bayless is going to have to reach into his own pockets, as he did in this case, and pay money
Under what circumstances can shares have a negative value? Kmart is in bankruptcy down lower in the floors of this building. The shares of Kmart are trading on the stock market for a positive price. Right?
Sure.
It's bankrupt, has a negative valuation, as far as anybody can tell, and its shares are positive trading. Now, somebody's going to have to put more money into Kmart, but the shares haven't gone negative. They can't, logically.
The president of Kmart is not going to have to write a check to Bank One to pay the interest on the loan as it comes due. Now, maybe Mr. Bayless doesn't understand market theory the way that other folks might, but Mr. Bayless knew that he was going to have to reach into his own pocket, and he was going to have to write a check to Bank One after Mr. Valinodi left, so that the loan would remain current. The record shows, Your Honor, that Bank One did not make a call on the personal guarantees of the $200,000 operating loan until the time in which it came due, which is well after Mr. Valinodi left the company. To get to that point, Your Honors, Mr. Bayless had to pay Bank One all of the interest, and that's a significant amount of money. Every month there had to be a check and it had to be written, and he knew that would have to be done. In addition, Your Honors, there's the non-economic but still very practical and very real task that Mr. Bayless was left with, which was running the company, dealing with creditors. And he was the person who had to do all the work and got stuck with all the responsibility. So the Kmart situation presents an entirely different scenario for the executives who are running Kmart. They get compensated in an entirely different manner than the people who are running a very small LLC like this one.
Could we talk about the Section 11C argument for a minute? Because it seems to me that under your interpretation, Mr. Valinodi could have walked away without paying anything and had no more obligations that you claim he has after paying $78,000. And it seems, something has to be wrong with an interpretation that would lead to such an anomalous result, unless I'm wrong.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, it is not actually correct, and nor is it in the record, that there was a payment by OFG of the $79,000 loan owed to Mr. Valinodi. So while counsel had stated earlier that that was the case, there is nothing in the record to that effect. And really what happened in that instance was there was a right to receive some payments. Some payments were made, but this was certainly not the result that the other side had suggested was the result. Secondly, the question of is someone worse off just walking away from the company than invoking the 10B mechanism? I think there are really two answers to that. The first answer is they're not. And the second answer is it really doesn't matter. Starting with the second answer first, in terms of it not mattering, this was the provision by which a fight in governance would be resolved. Having a fight in governance is not a good thing for a two-member LLC. It is to be avoided at all costs. There should have been a negotiated solution, just as there was a negotiated resolution when the two of the four original members of this LLC left many years prior. There wasn't a 10B result in that instance. It was something that was negotiated and worked out and signed by all the parties and resolved. So this is the mechanism, for better or worse. Now, as to the would somebody be better off walking away? Well, Your Honor, they clearly under 11C they keep all of the personal guarantees. But there are other, there are other issues involved in an LLC. There can be other differences between 10B and 11, Section 11. For example, all of those resolutions set forth in that formula in 10B. Would not be gone through in a Section 11 situation where there's an evening out, where, for example, if Mr. Bayless had gotten more money out of the LLC than Mr. Vallinati did, those things wouldn't be worked out in the Section 11 transaction in the same way as in Section 10. So the easily quantifiable economic issues between the two members do get resolved in Section 10B, and that certainly could have favored Mr. Vallinati if, for example, there was a different level of capital contribution or different degree of loans to or from the company.
Yeah, you argued that Mr. Bayless bought Mr. Vallinati's membership interest in Omnibus, but Section B doesn't use that defined term.
It says interest in the company,
okay,
Your Honor, and I think the only reading of interest in the company is the membership interest. Nothing in the agreement says that there's any kind of interest other than the membership interest in the company. So I think that's clearly what that has to mean. Otherwise, what else could it possibly mean?
It's a matter of personal guarantees. Parole evidence problems, but does the record tell us whether there was any discussion about these personal guarantees when the deal was being worked out where Bayless was going to buy out?
Well, the record does, in fact, have a memorandum that Mr. Vallinati wrote just before this occurred. He said, make a 10B election, and that should include this and this and that, but not the personal guarantees. And that's what's very interesting. Had we had a trial, Mr. Vallinati would have had an opportunity to explain why only a few days before the 10B offer was made to him, he wrote a memo explaining what he understood a 10B transaction to be, and he didn't say a word about personal guarantees. So we don't know whether he was being cute and he thought he could just get through this and then have his other member, his partner in this business, assume hundreds of thousands of dollars of personal guarantees of debt, personal guarantees made to third parties, by walking away and paying nothing for that. Your Honor, Judge Roedner, I would submit that would be the most anomalous result of all. If somebody could say, I don't want to continue in my position as a member any longer, and therefore I'm going to leave. If the company can make this loan payment to you, that's wonderful. And by the way, those $800,000 of personal guarantees made to third parties, they're all your responsibility. That would be an anomalous result. I want to touch upon briefly this notion of extrinsic evidence. The other side has suggested that somehow we're afraid of the extrinsic evidence. That is not so. I think the affidavit of the gentleman who wrote this agreement and explained exactly what it means, and that it completely shows that Judge Ashman's interpretation, our interpretation, is correct. It's a pretty strong piece of extrinsic evidence. But under Illinois law and the Seventh Circuit law, extrinsic evidence is no part of this analysis. The case that that counsel cited in the reply brief, the Murphy case, that simply goes to the issue of whether if there are contracts that are negotiated together at the same time as part of the same transaction, you read them together. Well, of course you do. Here we've got things like promissory notes that were executed after the operating agreement was executed that simply have no place in the analysis. The other cases that counsel relies on for using extrinsic evidence, the home insurance and the AM International cases cited in the opening brief, those cases are for introduction of extrinsic evidence to show that an agreement is ambiguous. Here, the other side responded in discovery that they're unambiguous. They've never changed that position, and they're stuck with it. It's the agreement that governs here. I'd also note in 10C, we have the key sentence, assume and become liable for all obligations of the selling member to the company. Counsel suggests that Judge Ashman seized on this meaning of one two-letter word, the word to. Well, I think it's pretty clear what that means. I think Judge Ashman understood it perfectly. It's an obligation of Mr. Vallinati to the company. That does not include obligations to others, like third parties, like Bank One, like someone you give a personal guarantee to. That's why this case is so simple. That's all that needs to be looked at to resolve this case. Even in the paragraph that immediately comes after that in 10C, it talks about the company sending out a notice to people saying that the selling member, here Mr. Vallinati, is not liable for the future obligations of the company. Well, certainly, that's a whole lot different from not liable for any of the obligations of the company. What Section 11 really shows us is if the parties wanted to refer to personal guarantees and say that somebody was either going to keep or somebody was going to take over personal guarantees, yeah, they knew how to say that. In 10C2, what Mr. Bayless had to take over and assume, there's no mention of personal guarantees, and that really resolves the question for us today. We filed a motion for sanctions because we believe their position is frivolous. We believe that Judge Ashman had gave them an opportunity to understand that their position was not consistent with the document, that all of these multiplicity of arguments they've raised about different parts of the agreement, how they could be viewed and turned and twisted and spun and this and that, really do not change the fundamental point here, which is the agreement does not require Mr. Bayless to assume these personal guarantees. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Anything further, Mr. Gregory?
Yes, Your Honor.
Quite a bit to cover. I won't spend any time on the motion for sanctions. I believe it itself lacks complete merit. You asked Mr. Hoffman about the Kmart situation. Bayless, he had no obligation to continue to pay OFG's debt out of his personal pocket. He had no obligation whatsoever. He's indicated in his papers that Vallinati escaped further capital and operational requirements. Nowhere in the operating agreement do those requirements exist. They simply aren't there. There was no obligation without unanimous consent to put in further capital. He indicated that while there was a fight in governance, there should have been a negotiated solution. There was a solution. It was in this agreement. It was Bayless. He decided, he voluntarily decided that he would go with the 10B structure. The court asked whether there was any evidence about discussion. In the record, there was. There was testimony that they discussed it. Bayless acknowledged his agreement and then changed course afterwards. The affidavit of the author of the agreement, you know, that's classic subjective extrinsic evidence. The objective extrinsic evidence is a letter that he wrote saying that the departing member, Vallinati in this case, would be relieved of all remaining OFG obligations. The Vallinati memo, there is a second memo in the same week in which personal guarantees are expressly covered. This was a comprehensive solution. There's no dispute that Vallinati wanted to get out. The essential argument that Bayless wants the court to accept is that this termination of the entire interest in the company, this exit strategy, the sale of the entire interest, that all
thank
he
you
did.
Very much, counsel.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Case will be taken under advisement.